Hi, you guys. This is Richard Sachs. You're back on Lost Arts Radio. Thanks for coming over. And we've got an old friend of ours who's come back for a show for something that you'll enjoy, I'm sure, is Gareth Ike from the UK. And he's got a new show that we want to talk about called Right Now and a bunch of other things. There's some stuff going on in the world that you might have known that's kind of important at the moment. And Gareth, I'm really glad you're here. I've got an idea where we could start. So thanks for coming over.
No, thanks for having me.
What I thought we'd do is just a little imaginary exercise in the beginning. Imagine that you were here just briefly from some other place, other realm, other planet, other dimension, where things are kind of normal, and you're visiting here, and you're taking on this form as a costume, and you're getting to talk to the other inhabitants here who don't know they're from where you're from, and they're walking around in costumes too, thinking that's who they are and busy fighting. You know you can only stay for a little while. What would you tell them for maximum benefit?
I actually feel like that probably is exactly what's happening anyway.
Yeah, it's not really make-believe. I'm just making believe it's make-believe.
Yeah, that's a very good question. What would I say to them?
You don't know how long you've got, but you're on the air for the world now.
To try and remember, I suppose. I wouldn't know what kind of form that would take, but to try and remember exactly what you are as opposed to what you believe you are at the moment, that we chose to be here for this point in time, to make a difference, to do something good, and that actually when all the days feel negative, which they do at times, certainly at the moment, that to remember that you chose this, and this was something that you felt you needed to do, and you felt you could do, you felt that you could achieve and you could make a difference. Yeah. 'Cause I find that sort of mindset sort of gets me through days where I'm not feeling particularly great, to be honest, is that actually this was a decision that I made to do this, and I wouldn't have made a decision to come here if I believed that we were going to lose, because I hate losing.
I know.
And I might have done it on the show before, so forgive me if I have, but I kind of put things into a football analogy quite a lot, and I think if you could get one game for England playing football and you could choose everything that happened in that game, every parameter, everything, every single thing, you wouldn't choose an 8-1 win against Trinidad and Tobago. You would choose Germany, World Cup final, 2-0 down. You come back to 2-2, they score a late goal, you equalize, it goes to extra time. You know, all this crazy stuff that you think, why don't you just win 5-0? It's got to be easier. But we create that because it takes us on a journey that we need to evolve. And I believe that's what we're doing right now.
So it's a lot that you learn during a game like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I know like people might think that sort of football or soccer is kind of silly, but actually, I remember having this conversation with my dad a few times. Football is very much like life. Like life plays out like a game of football in terms of highs and lows, and some things are not fair, you know. Sometimes you get a penalty given against you where you didn't even touch the guy, he dived, you know, where's the justice?
Right.
You know, it's very much like that, but you have to get on and, you know, pick yourself up and pull your socks up and get on with it. And sometimes in life you'll get a penalty when you didn't deserve it. And that's just kind of how life is. It plays out like a roller coaster, like a game of football.
Exactly. So you mentioned in the beginning that you would use the time to do something good. What's good?
Something to that's bigger than yourself, to help others that are not in a position to do that. And that doesn't necessarily mean like chucking some money to a guy on the street, but to kind of take whatever skills you have, because I believe that we all have different skills. We all have things that we're great at and things that we're pretty dreadful at, and kind of work as almost one unit to better everyone's lives. Which I don't think is that kind of difficult a concept, really. I don't think it would be that difficult to do that. You know, I know the governments around the world don't like that when you have communities that do that. There's a few in England at the moment that do that, where they look after each other. So there's no money changes hands or anything like that. But they, you know, you might have a plumber in the village, and then you might have a masseuse in the village, and there's a guy that grows veg, and there's a, you know, and everyone just does their bit and they kind of work to better each other. I think that would be a better world for sure.
So there's a lot of misunderstandings in this place you're visiting right now. And one of them is that some of these people playing these characters, forgetting the actor, thinking that they're the character, and they think, oh, the way to get ahead is to put other people down and get beyond them and climb on them, you know. And some of the ones at the top have a different misunderstanding, that it's actually empowering to hurt people. And they sincerely think that. Everybody's trying to feel better. They just got confused, and they're trying to do it that way. They're what's called bad guys.
I think it's easier to do it that way, isn't it? It's probably easier and quicker to drag someone down to your level than it is to try and raise yourself to theirs. Yeah.
So if they were listening to you and you wanted to explain to them why that might be a mistake, what do you think you would say?
Well, I'm a strong believer in karma. For a start, I believe that everything happens for a reason, good and bad, and that actually, you know, your actions have consequences, even if they're not necessarily immediate. But also, on the other side of that, like, I've, over the years of playing football and touring in bands and doing stuff like that, I've met quite a lot of successful people, what you would perceive to be successful, very wealthy, you know, big house, lots of cars.
Right.
And I've never met a happy one ever in my life. I've never met one that's
happy. Isn't that interesting? Because that's what they think is going to be like. That's the ultimate happiness.
Yeah.
More success than everybody else.
That's it. But that's the thing, you see. At the moment, we can, as not wealthy people, we can believe that I'll be a tomorrow man. So tomorrow will be better. I'll have more money tomorrow. If I get that job that I'm going for, that will sort my problems out. Because then I can get the car I want and the house I want, and I can get that girl that isn't looking at me twice, but she will if I've got some money. Yeah, and then what happens? So at the moment, we can have that. Not that I imagine other women, but I'm married, but you can have that imagination. And so that kind of somewhere over the rainbow thing gives you hope. And it kind of, whereas what, if you've got all that and you're still not happy, where do you go from there?
Yeah, a lot of them after that point do suicide as the next option. But
you do get a lot of that. Yeah, but like I say, I mean, there'll be obviously exceptions to that. There's probably lots of wealthy people out there that are living the life of Riley. But in my experience, they tend to be pretty miserable people, really.
Yeah. So they can change, right? Even at that point.
Absolutely.
Try something different.
Yeah, absolutely. Climb a mountain. Swim a lake. Yeah.
Right. And you mentioned something interesting about karma, which is cause and effect on this place. It seems to control everything. The time factor, because people say, well, there's people getting away with all kinds of stuff. And that's not actually true. But to see that it's not true, you need that understanding of the time factor.
Yeah. And I think also it's having the understanding that because something bad happens to you doesn't mean necessarily that something bad has happened to you. For instance, probably one of the best things that ever happened in my life was I broke my tib and fib to the point where my leg was basically flapping around in the wind and playing football. And so my football career was over. I couldn't play anymore and all that sort of stuff. And went through all the emotions of woe is me, through all the others, which was, you know, anger, because the guy did it on purpose. He went through me. So it's like, right, when I get my legs back, I'm going to go for him, all that sort of nonsense. And then you have this kind of depressed side where it was like, this is my fault. This is a karmic thing because I'm a bad person. So that's what happened to me. And then at the end of it, I came with actually like, bad thing happens sometimes. That's fine. I'm a decent human being. I'm trying my best and I'm going to go onwards and upwards from here.
Right.
And my life has been so much better since then. And it's, you know, my dad always says, best thing that ever happened was broke your legs. So yeah, but and so at the time I thought, what a horrendous thing to happen. Whereas I look back now, I mean, that was 10 years ago this week, I think. Yeah, wow, February. Wow. I look back at that now and I think that was amazing. That was amazing because it triggered everything that went on from there. My wife, two children, leaving the Isle of Wight where I was living, going nowhere, to be coming up to Derbyshire, new friendship groups, new opportunities. Then it all came from some scallywag two-footing me because I just scored a goal and he didn't like it.
And he didn't even realize he was helping you, probably.
No, not at all. He probably thought he'd really shown me. And I guess he did, in a way, actually.
So is anything happening with music in your sphere of existence right now?
I haven't been doing anything, to be honest with you. Absolutely anything. I I started when this whole kind of COVID nonsense started. I did a couple of online gigs, which I hated, but all my friends were doing them, and they're like, "Get on and do it," you know, these streams. And so I did a couple because try everything twice, and I hated it. It didn't work for me. Not being
able to see. What was it that you tried?
Just doing live streams, gigs, because obviously all the venues were closed, and it was like, I'm just not getting anything from the audience because there is no audience.
Right.
I'm just sat like this. I mean, this is different. I'm having a conversation with you guys, so it's coming back and forth. Whereas if I'm just sat here singing at you and I'm looking at myself, it's like, this is just weird. I don't get a vibe from this. I don't get the enjoyment from it. So
Were there a group of you in one physical place doing this online?
No, I was just in my house doing it. So that's another thing.
Just by yourself.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it really was not great fun, really. And then since then, kind of everything else has sort of taken over. I live in a terraced house with two young kids now. And so playing guitar is probably out the window in terms of the noise and annoying people. So I've sort of put it on the back burner for a bit while I, concentrate on doing right now and things like that. And trying to, you know, get as much information out to people as possible so that we can kind of be done with this nonsense.
How did Right Now start? What's the idea behind that?
Well, I was doing podcasts and they were kind of like an hour long generally, which was fine. But, you know, people don't necessarily have an hour to sit and listen to an entire subject. And the mainstream media were doing their, you know, their snippets. They were getting to the you know, talking nonsense most of the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, little 10-minute interviews, if that. Covering a range of subjects, keeping people engaged and interested so that they can then maybe go away and, you know, investigate certain subjects more if it's of interest to them. But we just basically looked at it and just thought, you know, the mainstream media have this wonderful looking studio generally. The sound, the quality, everything's fantastic. And then the alternative is in a position where they're making Zoom calls basically. And it's like, even though with Right Now, a lot of the interviews are video calls because they're with people all over the world. It's like, how can we polish this? You know, how can we just make it more palatable really to people that they'll take you seriously almost, you know?
Okay.
Because all of a sudden it's not, oh, where'd you watch that? YouTube? Yeah. Right. You know, that sort of thing. It's, it's more kind of trying to not compete with them because I can't be doing with them, but to at least take you to the same standard of production as them, in the hope that would attract, you know, bigger guests, that it would, you know, make people at least sort of sit down and take you seriously. And that's what's happened. Like the amount of times that we've had doctors coming on from the States, people like Dr. Peter McCulloch come on, and his first reaction was he sit down, come in the VMix call, so it opens so he can see the studio, and the reaction's like, oh, wow. You know, and it's like all of a sudden, this is, you know, we're trying to make a difference. We're trying to take it seriously, and you know, it seems to be going well at the moment. People seem to be kind of responding quite well to it.
Neat. Where is the studio?
It's in Derby, which is basically, if you got a map of England and you stuck your finger in the most central point, you would hit that.
Okay.
Our studios overlook the BBC, actually, which is quite amusing. It wasn't a intentional thing. It was just a turn of fate that these office blocks came up and available to be converted into studios, which is often a problem because they don't really want you knocking walls down.
Sure.
So we overlook the BBC and they overlook us, and it's kind of quite fitting, really.
Wow. So you're talking about a lot of people don't have an hour. What's the length of most of your shows now?
Well, the show's an hour, but each guest is around about 10, 12 minutes.
So it's a sequence of different people.
Yeah. So you can cover a range of subjects, but as often happens, you know, like everything's connected. So, you know, you can have a guest on talking about the COVID stuff. You can have someone on talking about the climate change situation. Then you've got someone else talking about the war, you know, Russia and Ukraine or whatever, but actually the three of them are all kind of combined in the same way. So the show kind of flows a bit. And a lot of what we've been trying to do is talk to people that the mainstream won't touch. So I don't know if it's the same in America, but here in the UK, they will have some people on the mainstream if they're, you know, anti-lockdown and maybe anti-jab mandates. They won't have any anti-vaxxers, but they'll have some anti-jab mandate people on there.
Okay.
They'll, But they'll only have famous people that are maybe famous for being a TV presenter or a footballer or something like that, and get them to comment. They will very rarely get a scientist or a doctor, because they'll be taken seriously. And also they absolutely won't touch people that have, say, had a vaccine injury or have a vaccine injury child. You know, the mainstream won't touch them. And so they're the kind of people that we get on, because it's like, if you're going to have informed consent, then you need to know what can happen. And if you choose then to go and do it, then at least you're aware.
Right. I don't think most people even know what informed consent means.
No, I don't either. I think it's become almost like, you know, a sort of nasty term now.
That's the essence of health freedom, really. So why don't you tell people what it means?
Well, you just need to be aware of every upside and every downside. And then you make your decision based on that, not based on coercion, not based on you're going to lose your job if you don't do this. Because this is the thing. It's like, well, you're free not to get it. It's like, well, not really, because if you've got a mortgage to pay and you've got children to feed and you've got a job and you get sacked tomorrow if you don't have it, it's not really you're free not to have it. I mean, you can stand up and fight, but and as it's happened in England, if you stand up and fight, you can win, because they've just U-turned on the NHS jab mandates, because over 100,000 NHS workers refused. And went and threw their uniforms at the Prime Minister's house. So that's what happens when you stand up. It's great.
So he got more open-minded overnight.
I think he basically just thought, I can't win this. Simple as that.
What do you think happened to him when he went into hospital? Because before that, he was kind of almost normal. You know, he was talking about freedom and individual rights, and people were supporting him as a really great leader. And then he went in the hospital and came out with a personality transplant, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even convinced it's the same person. I'm that far down the rabbit hole now. I think, you know, Saddam Hussein had 8 body doubles. It would, like, nothing would shock me anymore. But I think, you know, there's also a part of it where you've got, were you ever into Bill Hicks, the comedian? Because there's a Bill Hicks sketch where he's saying, basically, it doesn't matter what you say on the campaign trail if you want to be a president. As soon as you get in office, you will sit down and they will sit you in a dark room with all these great industrialists and whatever, and they will show you a film of the Kennedy assassination from a different angle, just to let you know what happens if you step out of line.
Yeah. This would be really too bad if anything like that ever happened to you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, he went into hospital and, I don't know, maybe someone had a word in his shell. Because you're right, he came out a different guy, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, you remember Jesse Ventura was elected, and the powers that be didn't expect it, in Minnesota, I think, as a governor, an independent. And he was saying publicly, what happened is he was taken to a meeting in this place in the basement of the government building there. And there was a whole group of people with him, just like you're talking about, all with suits and dark glasses, even though it wasn't sunny in the basement. And they said, these are the things you're allowed to do. These are the things you're not allowed to do. And other details of what would happen, I guess. And he was talking about that openly.
Yeah, people think, you know, people sat down watching TV at home think that this kind of stuff is too fantastic, that it sounds like something from a movie script. But this stuff goes on, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely, it does. So that could have happened to Johnson. He's, you know, he's a very strange character. But I think with the mandates, they basically didn't have the public opinion. They didn't have the support for it. And so they wanted to lock down over Christmas. They wanted to lock down over New Year.
Yeah.
And so they realized that actually the public here, I mean, I've never been so proud to be English, to be honest, because when I look around the world, how much people are just bowing down to this, and the English said no chance. I mean, the Welsh have bowed down, the Scots have bowed down, they all have. It's only the English, really. Just saying, you know, no more. But they, basically, the attitude of most people in England, there's a handful of people that are terrified of their own shadows, but of most people was like, well, you can lock us down if you want, but it's not happening, like, no chance. And so what was happening is the government were then doing so much polling. It was insane. You couldn't move for all the polls that were in the media and that were all over social media. The government was just polling and polling and polling, trying to find out public opinion, like, can we get away with this? And they realized they couldn't, so they didn't lock down. And so everyone had a great Christmas and a great New Year. And because obviously, as far as they're concerned, if they tell us to lock down and we don't, we just refuse. They've got nowhere to go from there. It's over. The dynamic is shifted. And that would look bad. Yeah. And so then if they go, oh, no, don't worry about it. We'll let you have it. And it's almost like, well, did you let us have it? Or were we going to have it anyway? You know, but at least by saying they're letting us have it, they've still got that sort of perceived element of power, which they certainly wouldn't have had if they'd have tried to lock people down, because no one was.
So you're saying they're trying to get away with it. And what it brings up that I think is hard for people to grasp, who are these people that they would even want to do that to everybody? I mean,
there seems to be a goal from the beginning to absolutely destroy economies the world over.
Coordinated,
absolutely. I mean, country after country, everyone responded the same way, you know, pretty much, a couple of exceptions, maybe Sweden,
but they said everyone else. There are some African leaders that said, wait a minute, if a pawpaw is testing positive for coronavirus, that might mean that there's something not right with it, and those guys got assassinated generally.
The other one
said the same thing.
Yeah, well, it was Tanzania president. He died, and then was replaced by a lady. I forget her name, but she's from the World Economic Forum.
Obviously. She decided everything is terrifying and everything should be locked down.
Yeah, reversed everything that he'd done. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's funny throughout all of this. Whenever I see someone say something, you know, like a mainstream media bobblehead or a, you know, an expert, whatever that means. Or a scientist, you know, eminent psychologist. I don't know why they're involved in everything, but I will put that. I'll take. Okay, who said that? Right, Dave Jones. All right, so put Dave Jones, Bill Gates. 99% of the time, it will come up connection, some kind of funding. But if it doesn't, okay, fine. I'll put Dave Jones, World Economic Forum. Bang, there we go. And it is honestly, it's every single time without fail.
The same thing happened with Trump in the U.S. in the beginning. He wanted a commission with Robert Kennedy to investigate vaccine safety, which doesn't exist, of course. And I think he was sincere. And then at his inauguration in 2016, he took $1 million from Pfizer, according to the documents that Kennedy found. And after that, he handed the country over to a mass murderer. Other than that, he was doing great.
Yeah. So Pfizer knew what was coming.
Yeah, it's been planned for a long time.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw some people were kind of trying to work out how long it would take to produce the number of vials that have apparently been dished out all over the world, and it's insane. It's insane.
That's a big project.
Yeah, how would you even begin to even be able to administer the numbers that they've administered, to be able to produce that number and to be able to ship that number? No chance. Unless it's just sat there.
A lot of pre-planning and coordination, you know, long before it actually started.
Oh, yeah.
So, since you're talking about rabbit holes, after looking at this for a long time, who do you think these people are and what do you think they're after?
I think they're after everything, if I'm honest. The complete control and destruction of humanity as we know it. Starting with, you know, the kind of on the sort of surface level, so your social credit system, you know, your mandatory vaccinations with goodness knows what kind of nonsense in it, and a completely obedient society with a much smaller population, which is what a lot of this culling is about, I think. But then beyond that, you know, you're then going into the whole AI spectrum, the fact that, you know, Elon Musk, who's supposed to be good cop in all of this, is smashing up, you know, thousands and thousands of satellites to beam down Wi-Fi 5G onto
that doesn't sound like a very planet. Good cop.
It doesn't, does it? It doesn't sound like a great cop. And so I just think, you know, absolute ultimate control of the population is the goal. And to kind of just strip people's humanity away, which I've sadly witnessed a bit over the last 2 years. You know, people would have been doing things like, I saw a video yesterday of a lady who tried to take her 3-year-old and 1-year-old to hospital because they'd had an accident. Three-year-old had they thought she'd broken her arm, and the one-year-old had damaged her back. So they turned up at a hospital in Australia, and they had to fill in this thing on the iPad in the emergency room, and they asked the mother, was she vaccinated? She said no, and they said, why? Have you got a valid reason? She was like, no, it's just choice. And then the security guard comes over and says, you have to leave. So, but so what kind of humanity is within that security guard? He's, you know, just following orders.
I was just going to bring that phrase up, because you've got those who are giving the orders. Actually, you've got levels and levels and levels, and all the levels are following somebody's orders right up to the top, which I think, you know, we can compete for rabbit hole experience, but I think at the top, it's not human. And which you would probably agree with. And it seems to me that what they're after, it's obviously step by step, because they have the technology to kill everybody right overnight if they wanted to. And they're not doing that. But it's moving in that direction. And it looks to me, I think it's a ceremonial sacrifice that is intended to eliminate the entire biosphere, including the perpetrators. I think it's a suicide mission, because what they're doing is clearly not leaving the environment intact for a remnant. They're wiping it out, including the species of animals and bacteria, and destroying the gene pool with a GMO everything. And I don't think they plan to stay here. I think at the top, they plan to get the reward somewhere else, and which is, you know, maybe merging with some kind of dark power that they're serving. And below that, they don't know that that's the goal. And they think they're going to be left as the remnant to get the world as their playground. But I don't think it's correct. But everybody, all the way up to the top humans, is following orders. So it's like this huge sequence of orders coming down. Yeah. I don't know. Does that sound believable?
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, but also I would, you know, suggest that if you are talking about something that is you know, a non-human force, then, you know, changing the way that the world is in terms of an ecosystem might be for their own benefit.
Well, if they were physical, I think that's true. I'm just seeing it as in a completely different dimension that doesn't plan to come here. But I don't know. I mean, we're going to find out. Hopefully we won't find out, actually. It'll be turned around. But
I sincerely believe it will be.
Yeah.
I sincerely believe it will be. Because like you say, if they could just do it tomorrow if they wanted to. You know,
yeah.
It feels very much like they need the consent. They need people to agree to it.
You know, I think they're also following a protocol. Because if it is a sacrifice in a religious sense, you have to do everything exactly right, or your God that you're serving is not pleased. And that takes time and notices and consent, like you said, and all that, which they're doing. And then the humans that are actually walking around in these costumes that have much more power than the darkness, the whole game is to try to keep us unconscious of that until they're done.
Yeah. It's a Bug's Life, or Ants. You know those films where it's kind of like that. If they ever realize how much they outnumber us, you know, there goes our way of life. And it's true, definitely. And I think that there is a shift in consciousness now. And what the whole kind of, for all the negative with all the kind of COVID era has done, is it's opened a lot of people up more to the idea that something else is possible. I think that's huge. Like, I remember seeing a meme quite near the beginning of this where it's just someone driving. So it's someone's view out the front of the car, and there's just a cow flying. And it says, you know, I was going to wonder what was happening, but it's 2020. So it's just normal. Like, just people are just kind of accepting a little bit. That actually maybe the world isn't exactly how they think it is. And actually maybe there is more to know. And so then people will then be, I believe, open to more stuff that 2 years ago, they'd have just laughed at you.
What's the difference between somebody following orders without even thinking about it, without questioning it, and somebody says, no, I can't do that. That would be against, you know, everything that matters. I mean, what's the difference? Because you brought up Australia, where these people weren't allowed into the hospital, right? There's so many police following orders to beat those people up. And what's the psychology of that?
Well, there you go. A mass psychosis. I mean, at the end of this, I mean, you would, the amount of money you could get from being a psychiatrist, because the amount of people that are going to be shot away. I feel like people are under some kind of, you know, almost like a mental illness, like a spell.
I think so.
They put on people, you know, and I see how people react. I mean, I think I remember mentioning this to you guys before, but quite early on in this, I was walking out. And so my daughter would have been not even two at that point. Mm-hmm. So I'm holding her in my arms, walking down the pavement, and a guy, probably about a similar age to me, stepped out into the road while holding his kid, similar age, rather than me walk past him. And I just remember stopping and just looking at him like, you've stepped out into traffic, and it's a busy road. You've stepped out into traffic rather than go near.
Like, was this because you weren't wearing a mask or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he wasn't either. To be honest, the kind of mask wearing outside thing is not really a thing in England.
Okay.
It never really has been.
So what made him afraid to step away?
Well, exactly. What's he frightened of? Is he frightened of, he's more frightened of me breathing on him than he is a, you know, I don't know, Ford Escort.
Right.
And it's like, but that's insanity for you to just go, I can't go near another human, so I'm going to step out in the road with a kid. I thought at the time, like, you're not right. Like, but then what happened then a little bit further down the line is my car failed its MOT. So you go in and they check your car over, make sure it's safe. And if it needs anything doing, obviously then, you know, to be roadworthy. So I needed, I think it was two new tires I needed. They'd fallen a little bit below the thread. So,
okay.
Tread. So I was like, okay, yeah, fine. So I'm sat there in the waiting room. There's no one else around. And they've got BBC News 24 on. And after about 10 minutes, because I don't watch it, I don't have a TV license, don't have any of that nonsense. I kind of sat there and I watched it for about 10 minutes. And I was like, do you know what? No wonder everyone's crazy. Because it's just churning it out. Just fear, death, new cases, variants, you know.
Right.
It's like you would think that, you know, you're in the Blitz. And then you look out and, no, it's totally normal. You know, it's almost like it feels like a War of the Worlds. You know, where it's on the radio and everyone starts believing it's real.
Think of piles of bodies outside the window and everything.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's the impression that they give you. Hospitals are overrun. Oh, my goodness me. You know, there's bodies in the corridors. And it's like, no, there's
yeah. No, they said that in the U.S. too, in the beginning. They said, and they showed the hospitals were just overflowing and lines of people who couldn't get in. And all. Then somebody went with a cell phone camera and started talking to the people in the lines, and they were all acting. They were employees that were asked to come out and make believe they were patients.
Yeah.
And the people inside those hospitals at that time were dancing. I mean, not patient. They didn't have patients, but they had doctors and nurses, and they were figuring out these new kinds of dances that took a lot of work to put together because they had so much time on their hands.
It was insane. I remember like when they were being shared all over social media, And people are going, hang on a minute, like these hospitals are supposed to be overrun to the point where we've got to stay in our houses.
Not yeah.
that they ever did, but we've got to stay in our houses. People are losing their livelihoods. People aren't seeing their relatives. You know, people aren't being able to go and see their relatives on their deathbeds. They're not getting to say goodbye because the hospitals are overrun. But these nurses are doing these, like you say, these TikTok videos, these dance routines. Like, hang on.
Yeah.
And some people were replying saying, but they're so overrun, they need to be allowed to unwind and chill out. And it's like,
right.
Oh my goodness me. Like, yeah, that you're under.
They can't imagine that there's this much coordinated deception going on.
They can't. But also, what I learned was happening was that the kind of the NHS was compartmentalized in the sense that I kept, because I've got friends that are nurses, and I kept seeing on social media lines like, we've been lucky at our place. Yeah, we've been lucky at our place. And then other people go, yeah, no, we've been lucky at our place as well. So their perception is, even though they're in an empty hospital, that actually everyone else is full, but we've been lucky where we are. And some of them were major cities, major hospitals. And so I'm thinking, so that's what they're being told. That's what the nurses are being told.
Right.
And so something went around social media quite early on in England. And it was that ambulances were going out early on when the lockdown first happened in March 2020.
Yeah.
They were going around with the sirens on. No one in them. Uh-huh. They were going around with the sirens on to create a fear that right. so people would stay inside. So it would feel like, oh my God, this is the third ambulance.
There wasn't even time to pick up all the dead people and all that.
Yeah, stuff. Exactly. So I kind of found that one a little bit hard to believe in a sense, because I was just thinking, would they really do that though? Because you know, you'd have to be up. Would they really do that? And then a friend of mine's a fireman, and he was doing. He's a chippy as well, so he came and helped us out with refurbishing the kitchen and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, we were chatting, and I said, "Oh, do you remember early doors in this when there was all that chat going around, you know, about going out and putting signs on?" He's like, "Oh yeah, they were doing that." And I was like, "Why?" And the fact was, they were saying to the paramedics, we're lucky here. So what we need is to keep everyone indoors. And if they don't think there's a threat, then they won't stay indoors. They'll come out and think everything's fine. So we need you to go out and make them. So actually these paramedics would then go, I'm actually doing people a favor. I'm actually saving lives by doing it. So actually it's a con, but they're made to believe that they're actually doing it for, you know, for good intentions. Actually, you know, and you're like, man, what a scam this whole thing is.
Incredible. And it's been built up for a long time. You mentioned some of the doctors coming on your show on right now. Some of those really great doctors who are brave enough to talk against the, you know, against the scam, still there are parts of it they can't grasp. A lot of those doctors think vaccines are wonderful, but this one is really questionable. This one, there was a mistake and it went bad. But all the others are really good. And many of those top level good doctors think that they can't grant. I don't know if you've run into that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's very much, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm just anti this vax.
Exactly. And they're really careful to bring that up, because being against vaccines is anti-science.
Yeah. It's the thing you can't touch. You know, there's a few things you can't touch in terms of debate and questioning, and that's absolutely one of them. You know, you will be shot down in seconds.
Yeah, I don't think they're ready psychologically to imagine that could be the case. They're busy, and they haven't taken the time to really investigate this injecting people with things on the pretense that it prevents disease. You know, when I looked into that, took it back to Jenner and in the UK, actually, in about 1796, which is where it started. And I couldn't find evidence of any prevention of disease. It changed the form sometimes, but a lot of disease is the body trying to detox itself, throw off garbage, and then they use drugs to stop it, which makes them sicker. So sometimes the form changed with the body getting upset with the poison that was coming in through the needle. But really preventing disease, I couldn't find it. And I think most of the doctors still, I mean, you have to respect the education they've gone through. It's like cult programming. And the fact that any have gotten through it, PhDs and doctors both, with common sense and coherent thought, that takes a really strong person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's with the COVID jabs, it's life experience that they will have witnessed what's happened, you know, as a result in terms of their you know, their hospitals and stuff. Because you have conversations, like I have conversations all the time with people. I tend to have a conversation, like I will not necessarily orchestrate conversations, but if people talk to me just in a, you know, a changing room at a swimming pool or whatever, I kind of find myself just putting a few points out there and then just sort of saying, it's weird, isn't it? And then I'll let them oh yeah, that is quite weird.
Right.
And then go away and think about it rather than preaching. But I was talking to this older fella, and he was nice. He was commenting on my daughter. He was like, oh my God, like my kids are like 30 and 39 now. But I remember these days, you know, fighting to get clothes on your daughter when she's out the swimming pool. And then another friend of his came along and was like, oh man, how are you feeling? He's like, yeah, a little bit. You know, and I was thinking they're going to say, you know, I've had the Rona or whatever. And all that sort of nonsense. And he was like, I had AstraZeneca. It done me for a month. I couldn't leave the house. Couldn't do this. Couldn't do that. Absolute mess. And the guy was like, yeah, that did me as well. But luckily, the boosters are Pfizer. So it's different. And the guy was like, well, you say that. I had my booster last week, and I've got to go in for an ECG, tomorrow, because of like heart
Wow.
And I'm just stood there in the change room, like, but this is a normal conversation now. And people are like, yeah, it's bad, isn't it? And then, like, the next day, I take my daughter to kiddie gym, like a gymnastics class. And there was a couple of mothers there masked up, and they were having this conversation about which one did you have, which one I had this one. Like, it's like the latest pair of Air Jordans. And then there was like, how did you feel? I was like, I was all right, to be fair. And then they were talking about someone else that was a mess. And you're like, this is just two experiences. And so how much is this everywhere?
It's become the main topic of conversation. Huh?
Yeah. And it was a conspiracy theory 6 months ago, 10 months ago, when people were going, do you know what? I don't think this is a good idea. Get him off social media. He's dangerous. And, I said this the other day, this whole Joe Rogan thing, like, you know, certain countries like Denmark and Sweden, the UK, they're U-turning because they've got new information, apparently. And it's like, but the new information was misinformation a year ago. Because what they're saying was stuff that people like us were saying a year ago, 2 years ago. And we're getting banned and shadow banned and kicked off social media for saying. And now it's like, oh, it's new information. It's not. Yeah. It's always been there. You just can't hide it anymore.
Wasn't Joe Rogan in trouble for saying that ivermectin was actually a good thing to use?
Yeah, he apparently took that. And, you know, you can't say that. But his two interviews, the one with Peter McCulloch and the one with Robert Malone, are what they've got an issue with. So you've got an eminent cardiologist who I think is the most published cardiologist, peer-reviewed cardiologist in the world, I think.
And so,
you know, qualified. He's not a dustbin man. He's pretty qualified. And then Robert Malone, who's obviously owns a bunch of the patents on mRNA technology. So again, you know, this guy invented it. It was part at least of his invention. And they're both saying the same thing. So What I found frustrating was then Rogan backed down a bit and came out and said, you know, I need to try and be more balanced. It's like, but Joe, you are the balance by having them on. Yeah. That's the point. Like, because the whole mainstream media, they won't touch these people. So we've got one narrative. So if you're going to be balanced, then what was he doing
to try to be balanced?
Well, exactly. What do you do then? Apart, you've got a cardiologist on there who says, this is what's happening. And you have the inventor of the technology saying, this is what I think the technology can cause.
And those are both guys that are examples of what we're saying, that they can't grasp that all the vaccines were a fraud from the beginning.
No, they can't. They can't grasp that. No. But what I found out recently in terms of certainly tech censorship is they have a flat blanket ban. And all it is if you do something or say something that could cause vaccine hesitancy, It doesn't matter what you do. So then you think, well, so if I go on there, you know, say I take the jab, imagine that I have it, and, you know, I get myocarditis, heart inflammation, my skin sores, all these kind of things that you see, I have a stroke, and I'm there and I'm videoing myself like I am an absolute mess, like I've lost everything. They'll delete that and ban me. And you're like, for what? Because it's not misinformation, because look at me, it's happening, it's real.
But
because it will cause vaccine hesitancy, obviously, because I would look at someone in that position and go, well, no thanks.
There's a psychology in that's really interesting. It's like, it's what they used to get Reagan in the US to give the vaccine companies liability protection for if they injure or kill your family, they're not responsible. And what they apparently told Congress in the 80s is, you know, we all know that vaccines saved the world many times. I mean, you know that because there was a movie called Outbreak when Dustin Hoffman saved the world with a vaccine. And, you know, nobody questions that. And so we have to protect vaccination no matter what. And we have this problem. They're talking to Congress. And the problem is people are dying from our vaccines and we're getting sued, which is really stressful. And we can't make money. And if we can't make money, we can't protect the world and save it with vaccines. So we need to be protected against any lawsuits for the people that we kill. And Congress said, that sounds exactly normal and reasonable. And they gave them the liability protection that's making it possible for what they're doing now. So you wonder, why would Congress do something so totally ridiculous? Is it because they were that dumb or because of the blackmail and bribes? And I don't know.
Well, a bit of both, probably. Also, you know, what interests do these people have? You know, I see a lot at the moment in terms of fact checking. It's almost always Reuters fact checking stuff. And it's like when it comes to vaccine, it's you've got, you know, Reuters and Pfizer, you know, having the same people sat on the boards of both.
Yeah.
And that's in a sane world. That's ridiculous. That's a conflict of interest that you know, otherwise we'd all be our own critics. You know, right now it's brilliant. Do you know what I mean? Right. You'd be your own critic, but the reason you can't be is because you have a vested interest in people not finding out. See, this is something I say to people, and I will, because I don't tend to, like I say, bring stuff up with people and kind of be one of those preachers, because I find it irritating and when people do it to me, and I find that it turns people off a bit. All right, oh yeah, come on, Ike's off on one again. But I will make a point to people. So you say, like, you look at Pfizer, for instance, which is now overwhelmingly the main producer and distributor of vaccines.
Yeah.
All the boosters in the UK are all Pfizer. So you go, okay, so company is the most sued company in history. It's paid out more damages than any other company in the history of business ever. Right. So, okay, there's number one. That's not a great start.
Right.
And among the lawsuits were bribing doctors, were falsifying safety data. Right. That's a pretty big one.
Yeah.
While at the same time trying to get the FDA to lock away the vaccine safety trials data for 75 years.
Yeah. Only for 75 years. You're right.
And you think, these don't sound like the actions of someone that believes in their safety data. Because if it's me, I've done the safety data. Look how safe it is. What do you mean 75 years? No, have it now. Look at it. It's amazing. Go on. Go and get one. Get one.
Well, they processed it almost overnight to give approval anyway. So, you know, it doesn't take very long to go through it.
No. And I think that's what a lot of certainly in the UK, the coronavirus legislation, the emergency legislation that just keeps getting renewed, even though there's no... I mean, in my opinion, there was never a state of emergency, but there's certainly not one now. Like,
right.
You know, all the rules are lifted. Everyone's just going back to work. Everyone, no one has to wear a mask anywhere. There's no vaccine passports anymore in the UK. They've all been scrapped, the whole lot. The mandates for NHS staff are all gone. Just everyone's back to normal. Fill your boots, mate. So there's no state of emergency. But because the coronavirus emergency legislation is still within time, then they can still use these so-called vaccines, because they've only got emergency approval. So you take away the coronavirus emergency legislation, you can't put another jab in another arm, because it's only got emergency approval and there is no state of emergency anymore.
Right.
Which is why they keep trying to keep this rolling on, new variants, testing more. I mean, we were like, lots of people that are pro-Europe tend to be absolute branch Covidians. It's bizarre the link between the two, but
right,
they started a trend on Twitter of like Plague Island, because there's so many cases. They're not cases, they're positive tests. The test is nonsense. And at this point, Britain was testing, I think it was like 1.4 million people a day, which was more than the entirety of Europe combined. And so then people are going, look, there's more cases in the UK than there are in any other country in Europe. And you're like, well, obviously, if you're doing more tests, if you're doing 1.4 million tests,
even if you
believe the test is accurate, which it isn't, but even if you believe it was, you would have to have a margin for error, because everything has a margin for error.
Right.
And that margin for error at 1.4 million tests will still be thousands of positive cases.
Yeah. And I think, you know, talking about what the experts and doctors can't get a lot of the time, many of the really smart doctors, like, you know, high level ones like you're talking about, they say, well, the test has a lot of false positives. They can't grasp, you know, the test it's like your dad says, not testing for the virus. It doesn't test for anything. And if you listen to Kerry Mullis, it's not a test. It's just a high-tech magnifying glass, you know, for lab procedures.
Yeah. Exactly.
If people could get that, the whole thing would be over.
It's also trying to get across to people, you know, the situation with the isolation and purification of this thing. Like, it's not been done.
That's really important.
It's so important. And if you can't show something exists after 2 years, you've got an issue. And I, you know, I kind of make that point to people, and then they'll go, oh, no, no, I found one. Look, here it is. It's been isolated here. There's a paper on it. And you go, right, okay, I can tell you before you even show it to me exactly their method of isolation. It's always the same. And what it is you take you've tested positive. So I take a bit out of you, right?
Right.
So I stick that in a Petri dish. Now, I can't get enough of the virus out of you, apparently. I can't get the virus out of you, which is very strange because you've just tested positive for it. But as a result of that, because I can't get enough of it, I have to put some Vero kidney cells, some monkey kidney cells have to be in there.
Right? That really helps with purification.
Really helps with purification. And then what I do is then I starve the cells of nutrients whilst putting in three types of antibiotic, two of which are absolutely infamous for damaging your kidneys.
Yeah.
So the Vero, oh yeah, the kidney cells. Okay. So, right. And then when the kidney cells die off, that's a sign that actually, no, kidney cells didn't die because you poisoned them and starved them. They died because your bit of virus was in there. That's what it was.
Exactly.
And you're like, if you looked at that and you go, okay, let's break this down then. Okay. So I'm in the basement now. I'm sorry, I'm in the basement. I'm in the loft. So I've been locked in here, right? I can't get out. Now, someone's given me a laptop bag. So I've got this laptop bag and I've got it in a lap. Now, no one opens the door for a week. So I get no food and no water. And the only time they open the door is to come in and pump me full of drugs, toxic drugs, right?
Yeah.
And then they come back in after a week and I'm dead. I'm lying here dead. And they go, told you, those laptop bags are killers, man.
That, exactly.
It's insane.
It is. It makes you want to know, why would anybody ever believe that stuff, let alone all these really, I mean, the high, what they call scientists now are people that believe this kind of stuff. They don't remember real science. They wouldn't even recognize it.
No, people have become completely separated from common sense.
And this includes really high level scientists. And many of them have a high IQ. They have high intelligence. And many of them are benevolent and they really want to do good and they don't see it. So there's something more to intelligence, maybe. How would you define it?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you can have educated idiots, you know, people with letters after their name and all sorts, and you have a conversation with them and you're like, God, the guy's a complete moron.
And they have mental capabilities like quick calculations and remembering vast amounts of stuff they read, and they're what people would call very smart.
But I also believe some people are basically just software programs as well, you know, like almost like a non-player character in a video game, that they react in the way that the software has decided that they will act.
Like, well, they've kind of been turned into that by their education though, partly, and the media, right?
Yeah, they're almost that. There's a separation from the soul, almost.
They used to be people.
Yeah, they used to be people, and they're not now. They're doctors and they're scientists, and that's how they would refer to themselves as well, because they become that. And
your first name has to be doctor.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that as well in terms of, you know, you find that sometimes with race and sexuality and gender and all this kind of stuff, where people are something first. As opposed to themselves.
Some kind of label.
Yeah, some kind of label. And this crazy tribal thing. And so I think that's a lot of where the mess has come from, is the tribal stuff. So, for instance, in the UK, if I see someone on social media giving it a big, you know, wear a mask, wear a damn mask, get vaccinated, blah, blah, I go, okay, right. I know your political persuasion. I know that instantly. I know that you voted to remain inside the EU. You were against Brexit. I know that you will be pro social justice, climate change, BLM, all the kind of things that are massively hijacked and fronts for the establishment. You will be pro all of those things. And then I just click on their bio and you go, yep, there it is. There it is. Every single time. Sometimes you might get a pronoun.
What does that mean that you could predict all that?
Exactly. It doesn't make any sense. And so if you're anti all the, I mean, obviously, you know, there's always exceptions, but if you're anti mandates, you're anti mask mandates, you're anti lockdown, 9 times out of 10, you are the opposite to all of those things. So you probably would have voted for Brexit. You probably would have voted for Trump. You, you will be, you know, kind of a little bit more, I'm not sure about climate change, a little bit more kind of, you know, willing to ask questions about that sort of stuff. And that seems extraordinary to me, because here in the UK, at least, they've compared it to the Blitz. This is the biggest, thing that we've had to fight against since the Second World War. This is the big, this is a catastrophe. And you, and, yeah. And so almost like, could you imagine people in the East End of London in 1941, 42, stand there going, I don't believe in bombs. You just wouldn't have. The houses are collapsed all around you. What do you mean you don't believe in bombs? Get an air shower. That wouldn't happen. Yet that is happening now. It's tribal. It's political. It's a virus that only seems to attack people that believe in it.
Right. And it only attacks people within 6 feet of each other also, in three directions.
Oh, yeah. And you can't catch it if you eat a Scotch egg, apparently.
Right. Right. Exactly. It's very strange. So we got people walking around in a trance. And as you said, if the significance of what you were explaining about isolating the virus, if that hasn't been, it's just, it's mind-boggling. If that hasn't been done, as far as we know, it doesn't exist. So, I mean, we have to assume it doesn't exist right now because it hasn't been proved to exist. So in the very beginning, when people in certain localities were falling over and actually some were in the hospital unable to breathe and their lungs were working fine, but they couldn't get oxygen, what do you think was going on?
I think lots and lots of different things were going on. You hear that a lot, you know, well, what are people dying of? It's like people are dying of lots of things.
Right.
A hell of a lot of things. I do, you know, believe that there are, you know, with a lot of the, you know, electromagnetic stuff, there is something to that, I think, in terms of people struggling to you know, get oxygen. But then also at the same time, I look at it also in a way that if you feel, if I feel unwell now, I feel a bit under the weather. Now, for me, I'll go downstairs, I'll get myself a cup of tea and I'll sit down, maybe with a blanket, and I'll be fine. An early night, I'll be fine tomorrow. But if I believe in this deadly of deadlies, then I'm going to go out there and I'm going to go and get myself a test. And that test says I've got this deadly disease.
Right? Yeah.
So I don't feel very well. I've got a deadly disease. Oh, God. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Panic, stress. You know, stress is the biggest killer.
True.
So then I take myself off to hospital. And, you know, to be fair, once you're there, if you get vented, it's game over. They stick you on remdesivir, and you're probably going to die of acute kidney failure, but it's going to say COVID on your death certificate because you had a positive test.
It depends which is first, you know, the remdesivir death or the ventilator death.
Exactly, yeah. They're just competing with each other.
Yeah.
Or the midazolam death. Take your pick.
Right. So the whole thing is whether people can break out of the trance or not, I guess. And it's the same thing with climate change. Right. Yeah. Which some people think that's going to be the next reason for lockdowns.
I almost feel like people don't want it to end. They like a bit of chaos. They like a crisis. It's almost like, you know, like I lived through the Second World War, you know, wow, that must have been crazy. Yeah. Rationing. Yeah. Bombs dropping. It was amazing. Oh my God. Like to survive that. And then it's almost like, you know, I lived through COVID. It's like, yeah, so did most people, but it feels like people almost need a crisis because it gives them identity. It gives them to fear is an addictive drug, isn't it? You know, people become addicted to stress and to fear. And to,
I guess it's a negative form of giving meaning to your existence, right?
Exactly. And also, I find it kind of takes away any need for kind of, I don't know, taking responsibility for yourself. You know, it's everything else. It's everything else that's the problem. We need to sort out climate change. That's that, you know, COVID is causing this, you know, and so no one wants to take responsibility and go, well, actually, why is your life the way that it is? Why don't you go and grab the world with both hands and do something with your life? You know, oh, no, I can't, you know, 'cause it's a pandemic. Like you feel that a lot. And especially also with the vaccine, you know, I always think like, if I say, you know, I don't want it, I'm not having it, And so then, you know, 6 months down the line, I come down with COVID. It's real. I've made a big mistake. I'm lying there in hospital bed. The vax would have saved me. I was wrong. It's on me. It's my fault. I took responsibility for myself. I got it wrong. And here I am, you know, tell everyone right. I love them. But that's on me, and I've got to take that responsibility. And that's hard. That's hard to take. You know, I caused this to myself. Jeez. Whereas on the other hand, if I go, do you know what? I will get it. And then I do get the jab, and it kills me, or it makes me ill. I'm lying there in a hospital bed. That's Fauci's fault. That's Biden's fault. That's Matt Hancock's fault. That's Boris Johnson's fault. That's Pfizer's fault. It's not mine. It's not
right.
My fault.
Right.
The fact that I didn't do any research or have any critical thought, all of a sudden it's not my fault anymore. I blame everyone else. Yeah, I think that's part of it. I do think that's part of it. And I saw something that was very interesting, actually. It was a conversation on Twitter, and most conversations on Twitter aren't interesting at all. But someone asked the question to a psychologist who, obviously, as a psychologist, was seeing through kind of what Sage were doing and what these other psychologist groups from all over other governments were doing in terms of, you know, manipulating their population and making their population fearful.
Right.
He could see through the tactics because it's what he does for a living. And so he was talking about that, and someone just asked the question. It's like, can you explain why some people saw it instantly? So March 2020, some people went, do you know what? This is nonsense. And they saw it immediately.
Yeah.
And then gradually, obviously, a lot of people have woken up throughout the time, but there's still people now 18 months later, as it was at that point, that just can't see it. Like, how have you seen it instantly? 18 months can't still see it. It still can't see it. It doesn't make any sense. And this guy was saying that from what him and some colleagues had looked at, that it wasn't definitive and all this sort of, you know, we need more, you know, studies and whatever, but they actually felt that there was a link between trauma. So whether it be an injury, like a physical trauma, abuse, you know, losing a loved one or losing a wife, a child, whatever, you know, like a something bad.
Yeah.
There's a link between that and the people that saw it for what it was instantly.
I mean, any time in your life, in your background, that primed you for noticing what was going on?
Loads of them. You know, growing up as a kid and dealing with all the stuff that went with that, with my dad and the abuse and stuff like that, that you were getting off of people and the media and people laughing at you in the street and all that sort of stuff, that hardens right. you up. And you also then, it's no surprise to you that people will do nasty things, because it's like,
yeah,
of course they will. Where, and that's why I think this first group that's had this trauma is like, well, yeah, people do horrible things. Yeah, they do. And so they can see that that is something, at least a possibility. Whereas there seems to be this other group where very much they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that because you're still almost looking through rose-tinted glasses. You still see everyone as wonderful, and unfortunately they're not.
Right.
So that was quite interesting as a conversation that actually, you know, that's not something I've really thought about, but maybe there is a link between.
Could be.
You know, because at least, you know, if you've been through bad times, you're more willing to take responsibility for yourself. You become very much sort of almost you against the world.
Yeah, well, against or for, it just doesn't matter. You have to be true to yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And at this point, the people in positions of power in the government and big corporations and organizations, the UN and WHO and things like that, they're almost all of this really evil mentality. And if you get somebody getting good into those positions, they have the meetings, like you talked about, to explain to them what they're allowed to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And it brings up the question, how do you change that?
See, for me, I think the change, how to change it has been, the answer to that has been, from the beginning, just non-compliance. So, I mean, protests are great, don't get me wrong. You know, we get tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people on the street, that's great. But just don't do it. Just don't do it. So if you own a venue, don't have vaccine passports in your venue. And so if one venue does that, okay, they'll be shut down. But if lots and then lots and lots and lots and lots do that,
then
all of a sudden, you know, you outnumber these people. And that's, you know, that's what I believe we've opened up more here, because the government realized that actually they're not going to go along with it. And so that could happen the world over if people just went, you know what, I'm not doing it. March 2020, we're shutting down your business. No, you're not. No, you're not shutting down my business. I need this business to feed my family. Go away. And if everyone had done that,
Yeah.
That would have been it. But unfortunately, they built this massive fear amongst people. And by the time people realized that actually this wasn't this big deadly thing that we were told, they'd already given the government 3 weeks or 3 months. And by the time you'd given that to them, they believed it was theirs to take. And you were sort of all of a sudden starting on the back foot. And so it's kind of taken almost 2 years for the people to turn that around. And, you know, to go from protests of 600 to 45,000 to 200,000 to half a million,
right,
to I'm not doing it anymore, to then, you know, I saw it, it's a microcosm, but I saw it in my local shop here, you know, masks, masks, masks. And then gradually you could just see people going, do you know what? Forget it. And I remember, because I've never worn one, I remember going in there once and the guy sort of looked at me and you could see the eyes and you're thinking, okay, go on then.
Yeah.
This could be interesting. He just went, ugh. And yeah, you just needed to see someone
wow,
else.
Wow, great.
That's what it is. So it's just contagious, you know, this, but not literally. But this, you know, that people can find this, I don't want to say courage, because it's not courage, it's your face, it's your rules. But, you know, that the more that that happens, the more people do that, and then it evolves and it evolves and it evolves. And, you know, I think just ignoring these world leaders, because they only lead if you follow. That's kind of my attitude.
It ruins the whole thing if you don't.
No,
and
exactly.
I think people forgot that it's not whether there's an emergency, because you have your rights no matter what. And in a free country, if it really is, the government can make a suggestion, you know, you should hide in your bathroom for the next month, but they can't make you do it, because you're, this is one thing that was good about the founders of America. They said, everybody has rights from God, not from government. So government can't take away any of them. And if there is a real emergency, they just have to say, there's a real emergency. We're afraid you should give up all your rights. They can't make you do it.
No.
And a lot of people have forgotten that, just like the isolation of the virus and everything else. In America, too, they're saying a lot of these really good leaders who have good intention are saying, well, it's not really an emergency. They don't get, it doesn't matter. Because even if it was a real emergency, government can help you. They can't make you a prisoner.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, the insanity of going from, you know, just a few years ago, the big Me Too movement, the my body, my choice, you have no right, a man has no right, as he absolutely doesn't, to you know, think that my body is his property, to all of a sudden... those people on that side more that were sort of so-called left-leaning that were pushing the Me Too movement are now very much, no, it is your body, our choice. And it's like, can you hear yourselves? Can you honestly hear yourselves? You know, for me,
right.
But very simple. Even if, you know, even if this thing existed, you go, does the vaccine work? Does your vaccine work? And if the answer is no, why do I need it? And if the answer is yes, your vaccine does work, why do I need it? It doesn't matter because you've got it. And so, you know, and I find as well, the people that you do see walking around with masks on in the UK, they're all the triple jabbed ones.
Yeah. The logic is gone.
It's gone.
And they're basically saying, if it makes you sick or kills you, it means it's working.
Yeah. I've seen things like that. Yeah. It shows it's working if your leg falls off.
Right.
Yeah. But it would have been nice to have been aware of that before I went and got it. You know, I mean, this is what's crazy for me. I've had 8 surgeries in my life. Cause I'm always breaking things. And you know, I had 2 eye surgeries as a real youngster. So I can't remember them. I was, you know, like a 2-year-old. So I can't remember them, but everything else I remember, I had 2 hip surgeries. I had 2 groin surgeries and 2 shin surgeries when I broke my tib and fib, it needed 2 surgeries.
Yeah.
And so, but I remember sitting down and talking to the surgeon who would explain everything that could happen. And these are like 0.00001% chance of these things happening. And he has to tell me.
He still has to, that's informed consent.
He has to tell me. And then the anaesthetist comes around just before, and I'm really nervous, obviously, because anyone that says they're not nervous before surgery is lying.
Yeah.
Was like, right, I need to talk you through what could happen here. And they give you all these dreadful scenarios that are 0.000 recurring one chance of happening, but they have to tell you. And so you end up getting wheeled in there, absolutely like bricking it. I mean, I remember my last surgery, the lady was an American anaesthetist. And so I'm chatting to her and I'm like, you know, And she said, oh, I'm from Boston. I went, oh, she said, do you know America at all? And I said, well, I'm a New York Rangers fan. She said, well, I'm a Bruins fan. So I might, she made a joke about putting too much in. And I was thinking, normally I'm a fan of a joke, but don't say that. Like, I'm nervous enough as it is, you know. But she had to give me that informed consent. Of course they do. And yet when it comes to something like this, no, you don't need it. You don't need it. You know, and you see the inserts of these vaccine pamphlets. When you unfurl them, there's nothing written there.
I know. There's it makes it much simpler that way. You get less complaints if you don't say anything.
Exactly. And you know, the doctors are getting an absolute fortune. In England, I think it's £25 per jab and an extra £10 if it's a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, that.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, they're just mass murdering people.
Yeah. And like you say, it was interesting you said about sacrifice earlier, because there was one day, probably about 3 or 4 months ago, where it was all I was seeing was like these footballers were dropping like flies all over the world. People were dying. I was seeing so much stuff in my feed of stuff. And I was just like, I can't get beyond now the idea that this is a ritual sacrifice. I honestly can't get beyond that now, because I can't see how it's anything but that. Because if this was a pack of biscuits, if you released a pack of biscuits on the shelves and it killed five people, those biscuits would be taken off of every shelf of every store in the entire planet. You know,
Of course.
Yeah. But this has killed, you know, nearly 2,000 that they're reporting. 2,000 in England alone. And you're like, could you imagine a pack of biscuits killing 2,000 people in one country and still being for sale, but not only being for sale, but you being told you're going to need to eat that pack of biscuits to keep your job?
In the US, they report about 1% of the deaths and injuries to this VAERS database. And even if it was 100%, there's, I don't know, it's near 20,000 killed at this point, I think. And, you know, they say that with the 9/11 inside job fake attacks, that killed 3,000 and something. And they use that as a justification to, you know, go to war against all these countries in the Middle East. But this one's killed. You know, if it is 1%, there's like close to 2 million deaths at this point, just in the U.S., more in Europe and the U.K.
Yeah.
And they're saying that's not a problem because it's totally safe and effective.
Exactly. They just repeat the line, safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective.
It's medical school. They learn that.
Yeah. It's a cult.
It is a cult. You sleep deprive the people, overload them with information, subject them to peer pressure in medical school, and keep it going for years. And say, if you give the right answers on a test, you pass. You know, it's not whether you believe it, it's memorizing what's right. Real science is gone. And you've got the general population thinking, well, a doctor said this, it must be true.
Yeah. I've had very little faith in that for a long time. And I remember going into a doctor's surgery about 10 years ago, and I used to suffer occasionally with corneal ulcers, which if like left unchecked, they can be pretty brutal. So I went in and I was like, all right, I've got a flare up. I need, I think it was Maxidex or Maxitrol, like these eye drops that, because you basically can't see it, you're in agony. And I don't like taking medication, and I generally don't. Like, if I've got a headache, I don't take a painkiller, I drink a glass of water. But this doctor was like, GP, some, you know, nice big wage, was what do you need? And so he started looking in a book, and then he got up his thing, and I saw Google. I was like, you're having a laugh. Oh, yeah, Maxitrex. And then wrote me a prescription. It's like, which one of us is the doctor? Like, you've literally Googled that.
Yeah, the computer tells you what to prescribe, and it gives you a categorization of what the illness is. The people just follow orders.
Yeah, give me, you know, 80 grand a year, 80,000 pounds a year. I'll just sit there and Google what your symptoms are.
Exactly.
Write your prescription. It's an easy gig, isn't it?
It is. So we have a lot more to talk about, but I'm watching the time, and I don't want to take too much of yours, and I know you've got things to do. So to wrap it up for the moment, about right now, how do people watch it? What's your plan for what's coming up on it? And anything else you'd like to leave people with?
So it goes out on a Friday night at 7 p.m. UK on iconic.com.
Okay.
Which is a subscription-based platform, but there is a seven-day trial running all the time. So you can go in there and spend 7 days watching all the films and documentaries and series that are on there. There's got thousands and thousands and thousands of hours worth of material on there. The first 20 minutes we put out on the socials for free every week. And then we put out clips and stuff for free. So we're trying to get as much of Right Now out there as possible. And then what we do with Right Now is we do these short interviews. And then my friend Rich does something called Right Now Deep Dive, where he will take one of those guests and we'll spend an hour and a half talking to them.
Okay.
So you can, you know, really, really expand it. So this week we've actually got Christine Massey, who is a Canadian activist who, she basically started off the Freedom of Information requests in terms of the isolation. So, and purification of the virus. So she wrote to people, healthcare providers, healthcare trusts, governments, public health authorities in,
right.
about 30 countries. And she got over 200 responses, and every single one of them says, no, we don't have any of it.
So that's great. Wow.
Yeah. So we're talking to her. We've got Aurelian Rowe, who's a podcaster and activist in Romania, who's doing loads of really good stuff there. And he's talking about obviously growing up under the communist regime there, and how basically that is what is happening. You know, he was saying, like, you know, we look at Trudeau and we're like, this is what we had when in the 80s here under a communist regime. The rhetoric is exactly the same.
Yeah.
It goes
yeah.
into the psychology of that and the wording of what they're doing. And then we've got NHS 100K, who are the 100,000 paramedics, doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, midwives that all stood up and refused the jab. So we've got a paramedic coming on who's lovely to talk about that and what they've been doing in terms of their activism. And now, because they've reversed the mandate against NHS staff, all the care home staff have already been sacked because that mandate came through.
Yeah.
So they're now fighting to get these people their job back and stuff like that, which is great.
Wow.
And then our final guest I'm trying to remember now. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So we've got what's his first name? I'm struggling because it's a Dutch name. It's hard to pronounce. But he's a podcaster who's been had everything deleted from Spotify. And so we're talking about that and the fact that, you know, Spotify is almost being put up as this bastion of free speech a bit because they've not got rid of Joe Rogan, and it's like, well, hang on, they've been getting rid of people for a long, long time. So
yeah,
so yeah, we're talking about that. So they're the four guests today. We often have four or five.
Wow.
Guests.
So how do you find enough time to track down that number of guests all the time? That must be a big job.
It was tough at first, because at first I was doing it all on my own. And so I was writing all the questions, researching all the guests and sourcing all the guests. And it was a real tough slog, to be fair. But now we've got a producer called Gemma Cooper, who actually was sacked by the BBC. She was the BBC for best part of 40 years.
Perfect.
She was so best part of 30 years. So she was sacked for being anti-lockdown and coming to protests and stuff like that. So she's joined us as a producer, and she's great. And so because the show's grown a bit, we now end up having guests come to us, which is amazing. So a lot of the time we still have to go out and try. If I see something, I'm like, my God, this story is amazing. We need to make contact for that person.
Right.
But often now people will contact us and, you know, I saw Right Now this week, you had so-and-so on. I've got a friend who actually blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Right, get them on. Yeah. And so it kind of creates itself, really.
One that I've been trying to get to that I haven't yet that I'd really like to, I've talked to the people under him, is Ricardo Bossi. Do you know about him?
No.
He's the leader and probably the founder of a party in Australia called Australia One. Really inspiring guy. He's got a military background and he's been once or twice on Alex's show.
Right.
Where also Right Now is on band.video too, right? That's the free part.
Yeah, the free 20 minutes is. So this week it's Christine Massey. So we'll be talking about that.
So
isolation.
So if we find a way to get to Ricardo Bossi, I think that'd be great. Maybe you can figure out how to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Between the two of us, I'm sure we'll find a way.
Yeah, he's really inspiring person and very brave, because the ruling powers in government are not really very appreciative to the ones that want to displace them.
No, Australia's, it's a crazy place.
Yeah, they need help. Okay, well, thank you, guys. It's very inspiring, and I'm very grateful that you're out there doing this. This is incredible.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hopefully, we'll talk again before too long. Yeah. So, hold on. We'll say goodbye in the break here. So, there goes Gareth Icke, you guys. And he's doing incredible work. That's why one reason I wanted to have him back on. He's been doing iconic.com for quite a while, and he's got all kinds of clips from the free part of the show on GarethIcke.com. And then there's a seven day trial for the subscription on iconic.com. And we just checked, and that's I-C-K-O-N-I-C.com. Sounds like a great show. I haven't had time to really get into it yet, but I know Gareth does great work, and some of the guests that he's talking about having on are incredible. So I would recommend it. I'm thinking of staying more in touch with it myself as time allows. And it's just really refreshing to talk to somebody that aware of what's going on. And it's not just somebody that's related to David Icke. Gareth is doing incredible work on his own. So I really recommend taking a look at that. And both of the websites, GarethIcke.com and iconic.com. Also on band.video. Yeah, I wanted to remember that too. BANNED.video. There's iconic.com puts up the free part, the first, I think he said 15 or 20 minutes of the shows, which go an hour, are on band.video. So you can have a lot of the material that way as well. And to stay in touch with us, lostartsradio.com is the main website. And that's got links to all the different platforms that the shows are on, lostartsradio.com/live. And it's got a donate button on lostartsradio.com if you want to help us stay on the air, and a Subscribestar link. And if you share the links, it helps us to get by the censorship. And we really appreciate that very much. Bottom line is, take care of yourself and work on your own. Get your physical health back. Stay as wide awake and conscious as you can. Question everything. That's real science. Question authority. Don't be a zombie. And remember that everybody else is in the same situation, walking around unaware that they're being a zombie asleep. And everybody's capable of waking up. And you don't have to run up to them and shake them and convince them of anything. You just have to do it yourself, and it spreads. So I think that's the main thing. Take care of yourself, and you'll be a massive positive influence on everybody else. So thanks for spending the time with us. I appreciate it, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon. Remember, we all also have Saturday shows, the current events show called Lost Arts Radio Live, and Planetary Healing Club, which has its own page, planetaryhealingclub.com, getting into deeper aspects of all this stuff about waking up. So that's about it. Have a good rest of the weekend, and look forward to seeing you next time. Take it easy.